Now on RT Radio 1, on tonight's Arena, shortly we'll hear from Oscar winner Sofia Coppola on her film Priscilla. Oscar nominees Paul Giamatti and Alexander Payne on The Holdovers. And we'll hear from Irish national treasures and multi-award winners Paul Mescal and Andrew Scott on their unusual and romantic film All of Us Strangers. But first, to Oscar winner Wes Anderson, who spoke to Sean about his most recent feature film, Asteroid City.
You're listening to Arena.
With his strikingly vibrant visual flair and a penchant for what we can certainly call esoteric storytelling, the writer and director Wes Anderson is very much his own cinematic genre. This has been the case since he started making movies, and now, after more than 25 years in the business and on the cusp of releasing his 11th feature, he is probably realising that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, even if the imitator is an AI programme entertaining people on Twitter. More on that anon. The Wes Anderson cinematic universe, vast and layered, contains adored films like Fantastic Mr. Fox, The Royal Tenenbaums and The Grand Budapest Hotel. And now he's back with Asteroid City, a wistful comedic tale within a tale set in 1955, chiefly concerned with strange goings-on in a small desert town famous for the meteorite that blasted a crater into the landscape there thousands of years ago. In the weekend where we set our scene, astronomers and the military are hosting five so-called junior stargazers, science award-winning genius children, their parents and their inventions. But that is to ignore the play within the play element of this film, which unfolds in a most intriguing and unusual way. And the cast? I'll go alphabetically on this one. Seems kind of appropriate. Adrian Brody, Steve Carell, Jarvis Cocker, Bryan Cranston, Willem Dafoe, Hope Davis, Matt Dillon, Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, Edward Norton, Margaret Robbie, Jason Schwartzman, Tilda Swinton, and the list actually goes on from there. It truly is a star-studded film. Asteroid City opens this weekend, and I'm delighted to say that I spoke to Wes Anderson earlier today in his only Irish interview. Before we hear from him, let's get a flavour of the film. In this scene, junior stargazer parents are drinking vending machine martinis and swap notes on their overachieving children, while motel manager Steve Carell earwigs Liev Schreiber, Hope Davies and Stephen Park among the actors whose voices you'll hear.
I strongly question whether your daughter's silly putty resembles anything from outer space.
It's not silly putty. It's called S'mores Tosium.
This is excellent.
Thank you. It's really all the machine's doing.
What the devil do you know about astrogeology anyway, JJ, whatever that stands for?
I just maintain the workings.
Sally's thesis is supported by...
flimsy, outdated evidence.
I beg your pardon.
Not in my opinion. I like the silly putty or S'mores Tosium. In fact, I'm just quoting what he said.
Your son's project might very well have killed us all today, by the way.
Coming from the family that brought us the electromagnetic death ray.
It's a weapon. Of course it's lethal.
So you admit it.
Not to mention Brainiac's flag. I mean, is he trying to provoke World War III or something?
The jet propulsion belt is eminently safe. I'd allow an 8-year-old boy to operate it. In fact, I did. Ricky's cousin Chip, and he broke the solo flight altitude record.
They're strange, aren't they? They're children, compared to normal people.
Yes.
That's correct.
It's true.
Wes Anderson, writer and director of Asteroid City. Brilliant to have you on Arena with us this evening, Wes, and congratulations on the film. It was Bryan Cranston, I think, who put it so succinctly. I thought, thanks for explaining that to me so well, Bryan. This is a film about a TV show about a play. It really tells us how the story is told. Why did you want to tell it that way?
Well, you know, I would say sometimes when in my experience, when you're writing a movie, first there's your intentions, and then there's whatever the thing just wants to become. My intention was I wanted to write a role for Jason Schwartzman, and I wanted to tell a story about this father traveling across the country with his children who had experienced something catastrophic in his family, and that story. And the way it came out was we're making a film about a television show about a play being produced, and that most of the movie is a play within a television show within a film, and it's extremely complicated. Every character in the film is both the character of an actor and the character that the actor is playing, and they are at least two roles for each person. But I think it's, I don't think you have to think about it much when you watch the movie. I think it leads you by the hand.
It does do that. But one of the things that really struck me was the interaction between the theatre side of the story and the film side of the story, if you like. It struck me that you were telling us something maybe about your own love of those two media.
I've always loved that. I've always, when I go to the theater, I sort of wish I could go backstage, not go backstage to meet the actors, but to be part of it, to be part of the company. I've always been drawn to that. In this story, somehow the characters, the characters of the actors who are playing these roles became the same as the roles they're playing. And we sort of have the emotions and the life experiences that are happening move back and forth between the performers and the performances in a way that we didn't quite anticipate.
I can't imagine, though, that you don't have everything planned out very meticulously before you go into a shoot, because it is such a complicated structure. You can't kind of free fall into that.
I have to say, I do tend to plan it out pretty carefully. Over the years, I learned that the more precisely I get myself ready, the more free I can be and the less likely I am to make a mistake. And even the description of this movie has probably got listeners extremely confused. But I think the way it's told is actually quite careful. And I think the cast we have is so good, they pull you into it, I would hope. And you can experience the story without this all being a distraction.
Yeah, because again, I'm quoting Bryan Cranston, I think, when he said, your direction to these actors was just tell the story. Don't get bogged down in motivation and the like. Tell the next bit of the story. But Scarlett Johansson talked about this atmosphere on the set that was more like theatre, that they seemed to have the freedom of theatre, that space for an actor to give his or her expression and interpretation of a character within it. How important is that? How do you get that dynamic on set when you have such a meticulous structure?
Well, for instance, the Scarlett Johansson and Jason Schwartzman, they have a sort of cycle of scenes, a sort of suite of scenes together. They're staying in hotel rooms, little cottages, motel cottages across from each other. And the bathrooms have windows that face each other. And they have a series of conversations between their two windows.
This isn't the beginning of something, Augie.
Isn't it?
Is it?
Probably not.
Unless maybe it is.
I don't like the way that guy looked at us.
What guy?
The alien.
Well, how did he look
like
at us?
Like we're doomed.
Maybe we are.
Well, the place where we shot it was a desert we had sort of built, and it was a big empty place with giant rocks and mesas and sand and our little town in the middle of it. And when we shot these scenes, there was no one there. It was just this little place we'd built and just the cameraman and the person holding the boom mic, and I sent everybody else away. So for me, it's just being in a very quiet place in a little invented desert with these two actors in their windows. It was like going to a play for me. I watched Scarlett Johansson play these scenes in this window, and I was like an audience at a play. And the real thing that makes the atmosphere on the set, I think, is that these two great actors are staring at each other, playing a scene, and they bring the atmosphere more than anything that I could do.
And it's not always just two-handers like that. There are scenes here where we have 8, 9, and 10 people on the set all at the same time, dialogue overlapping, as if we're kind of in the middle of this town and there's stuff happening all over the street that you're managing to capture.
What we did have, what we have is a great cast, a big cast of so many good actors, Tom Hanks, and we have Hope Davis and Liev Schreiber, and we have Tilda Swinton, and we have Matt Dillon and Adrian Brody, and all sorts of people. And they when you hand them a scene, they bring it to life, and it's so much fun to have them. And that's really what, you know, carries you through.
We're also, there's an extraterrestrial element to the story, and we're in 1955 in America, very particular time, just post-war.
Yeah, well, I think, the thing with that period is there's a sort of placid surface. It's Eisenhower, America. Backyards and golf courses and Cadillacs and things, but there's paranoia. There's something left over from the war in many of these men. In our movie, you might notice that almost every man carries a pistol, and there's fear of aliens. Not the big aliens with the communists. But in America, they also, that metaphor kind of was quite noticeable in American movies in the 50s. There were lots of stories that involved invasions and some strange paranoia of that time. And all of it sort of informs the next decade, the next generation who really react to their parents in a kind of profound way. So I guess all that kind of found its way into our story.
But that language of invasion is often, comparisons are made with the language of migration today, that it's used in a very negative way to compare it to invasion, to compare it to this kind of extraterrestrial alien idea. Was that playing on you in any way, do you think?
Well, I think when you're writing a movie, you're doing something kind of improvisational, and you're always reacting to what's going on in your life. You might be using something from your own family history or from people who you've known or just the thing you've been thinking about. But inevitably, what's going on with you day to day finds its way in. Part of what happened with this movie was the whole planet came to a halt. And, we were in the strangest lockdown situation, and that certainly barged into our story, and it became a part of it. It somehow seemed right for it, oddly.
It dictated that it was there. I mean, the way you've described the set, it's such an analog set, if you like. Things are real. Nothing is kind of put in after the event, edited in as a special effect. The whole chatter about AI at the moment, I mean, the sort of memeing that is going on out there. You yourself have been, I don't know whether you consider yourself the victim of it or that, are you joyous about the memeing in and around it? Are you fearful of what has been handed over to AI to create?
Well, I think, I don't, for in relation to my own, the memeing of myself, I've managed to recuse myself from that. And I don't see any of it. The only thing I would like to have is I'd like to AI some kind of copyright attorney and see if it can algorithm me some kind of royalty from some of this. But I'm sure that's not going to happen. I guess I don't find AI as ominous as I might. What I say is if when you sit and think about it and when you read what people are saying about it, you start to say this is kind of doomsday and doomsday for a lot of creative work. But I can't say that I find myself obsessed with it. I then just carry on. And we'll see where that all leads. What can it do? What are its limits? Things do have limits, even when they seem a bit limitless like this. I don't know. Has someone ever told a good, has AI done a really good joke?
I'm not sure, but video didn't kill the radio star. I doubt AI will kill the auteur.
Exactly.
Wes, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hi. Terry West, what's your name?
Priscilla Boyer.
I see you coming here a lot. Is your family stationed here?
Yes.
Where are you from?
Texas. My dad just transferred here in August.
That's so. Well, how do you like Germany? Well, I book the entertainment here. My wife plays here sometimes.
Neat.
You like Elvis Presley?
Of course. Who doesn't?
Well, I'm a friend of his. My wife and I go to his house sometimes when he has people over. He's always glad to see folks from back home. We're going this weekend if you want to join.
Have to ask my parents.
Well, all right. See you around.
The story itself, the story of Priscilla. When did you first come across it? I'm guessing it was the book Elvis and Me. When did you start reading that, and what struck you about it, Sophia, that you thought, that's a film I want to make?
I had the book around. It's just kind of, an old paperback that seemed like a fun vacation read. And I kind of looked at it, you know, over the years, but never really paid that much attention. And then a couple of years ago, I was reading it and I was like, so struck by it. Like, oh my God, I didn't know she was in high school. I didn't know when she lived at Graceland, and just all these interesting details. And I was really surprised with how revealing it was, and how relatable it was, of just kind of the experiences that all girls go through, of your first kiss or all these experiences, but in such a really wild setting, unusual sort of setting.
Yeah, not many people, let's face it, go through their first kiss experience with somebody like Elvis Presley.
Yeah, exactly. So it was like kind of looking at all these markers that we go through to grow up, but in such an unusual way.
So the reading of the book was one thing. I guess starting a conversation or a set of conversations with Priscilla was a whole other ball game, and must have opened up the script or the potential for a script to you in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I started thinking about it, and I just thought it would be a movie I'd be excited to make, to tell the story that is so unknown. And she's such a famous figure in American, pop history, and that I was surprised at how little we know about her. But I reached out to her to see if she would be even open to the idea of a film being made of her book, because she wasn't looking to make it into a film. There had been a TV movie, and I guess in the 80s or 90s, so she said she would. I was nervous to call her and ask her, but she was very, very kind and said that she liked my films and that she would think about it. And then I heard that she agreed to do it, and so then I started working, just going through her book and then saving all these questions for her. And then I sat down with her and spent a lot of time talking with her and asking her questions.
The first thing that struck me in the opening sections of the movie, we're dealing with a 14-year-old girl and a 24-year-old man. From the outset, this is very difficult territory to navigate. Now, it's been told from the point of view of the 14-year-old girl, clearly, but you must have had some worries around that particular aspect. It's an important aspect of the relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And she was like, everyone's known about that for a long time. And she was, referred to as like a child bride and stuff. But I knew that about her, but it was really interesting to hear from her perspective, how she felt about it and how she experienced it and what really, went on between them. And I just tried to show her experience without, imposing my judgment on it, and try to, discover what it was like for her.
Yeah, that is the difficult thing, not to impose judgment. And yeah. I'm wondering, was it things that she said to you that helped you not impose judgment in that way, or how did you go about that?
I've been definitely talking to her, and then just her story is written in a very vivid way, and just kind of staying with what she felt. And I know what it's like to have a crush on a rock star as a teenager. We all, probably all girls have, so who wouldn't be seduced by that? And so I had to really kind of suspend my adult parent brain and just focus on her reliving those moments.
What are the kids back home listening to these days?
Bobby Darin.
Oh, yeah.
and Fabian. Anywho.
That's good. I thought they might have forgotten about me.
No.
What about you? You got a favorite song? Well, you made me guess.
Heartbreak Hotel.
Went Kiss the Lion, huh? Wow.
The other side, I suppose, did you have to put your adult brain to the one side, adult parent brain to the one side? Because even when we look at what her parents did, first of all, allowing her to go to the party, that's one thing. But allowing her then to move to Graceland at the age of 17 to complete her education. I know 17 is, you know, it's heading towards adulthood. But it was a big move to let her move to Graceland and live in Elvis Presley's house.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking, especially they were protective parents. And it just speaks to, you know, the influence of, you know, celebrity at that time. And also she had a lot of drive of, you know, of really putting stress on the family and having that impetus to get there and saying she would find her own way there if they didn't let her. So I think the parents were, you know, scared of that she would never forgive them. But it's hard to believe. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, because if it wasn't true, you'd say that you've gone too far in the making up of that in some ways. The other side of this, of course, is that, and you manage this, and I know you're telling the story as told to you by Priscilla through the book and through your conversations, I'm guessing as well, you know, that they slept in the same bed from she got to Graceland, but that sex was not, certainly from Elvis's side, was refused until they were married. That side of it, did you find that absolutely and totally credible, first of all? And you were also talking about an icon here in Elvis Presley.
Yeah. Yeah.
That must have been another difficult line to tread.
Yeah, I just tried to focus on her story, and I felt like her story deserved to be told, and that was what I was focused on. You know, we've heard a lot about him, and I mean, it's a little about her. So I tried to just make that the focus and the priority to tell what was her side of this whole experience. And she really insists that that they didn't sleep together until their wedding night. So I'm just going by what I know from her.
Mm. Yeah, well, you have to. Yeah, I suppose you have to take what she says. Otherwise, there's no relation.
She really insists on it. I believe her. I mean, I think they did other things that, you know, I don't know how appropriate it was, but on that part, she insists on that. But
yeah, there are other aspects. I mean, there's a scene in the movie which I find deeply disturbing, a kind of a Doll's House type scene in some ways, where she's paraded out in. Priscilla is paraded out in a number of outfits, and Elvis and his coterie are commenting on them. I mean, it really is upsetting to watch that type of thing.
Well, you're a sensitive man. I think it is. I think it's really intimidating, and she's trying so hard, you know, so common at that time to, you know, please her man and be, you know, what his idea of, you know, an ideal woman is. And it is, I think it was uncomfortable for her to shoot that, just to have, it's intimidating to have this all these guys
even in the shooting of it. There was a kind of intimidation, was there?
But she could feel that, like she could do the scene, because she said, oh, it is intimidating to have these guys all sitting there staring at her.
Black hair and more eye makeup will make your eyes stand out more.
Mm-hmm. It's 4 o'clock, boys. We gotta go.
Barbecue's
waiting.
Come on. The other aspect that struck me, and I wondered if you had drawn parallels between Priscilla's story and obviously Marie Antoinette's story, whose life you also told in a biopic. Two young women, one could argue, possibly naive, but that's another day's work, possibly. But they were certainly brought into very powerful situations, or situations where there was a power imbalance. Did you see those parallels? Did that affect the way you approached this film?
Yeah, no, I definitely saw similarities, and I thought, oh, is it too similar? But I think, but there's definitely similarities. But then there were also a lot of differences that were, you know, like stimulating to me to make. And I think Marie Antoinette had no say in ending up in Versailles, where Priscilla really made it happen, and she was really behind. She really had the drive to get there. And but there's definitely similarities of a young person navigating a world and finding their identity through this, through a hard situation.
I know you've said to me a couple of times that you really wanted to focus on her story. Difficult. I mean, a wonderful job done by Kayleigh Spaeny, obviously, in the part of Priscilla, but you also have Jacob Elordi in the part of Elvis Presley. And there's so much magnetism in that character, and Jacob Elordi has his own magnetism too. Striking that balance and making sure that that didn't pull focus, was that a difficult process?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It was really important that he is this big figure, but he can't take over the story because it's her story. But we had to also show his charisma. So that was definitely a balance that we had to find, I think, in the editing and while we were filming it.
And how did you go about that in terms of just, you know, the dynamics of a scene, making sure that the big character doesn't take it over? How did you approach that as a director?
Yeah, we just had to always be aware of where she was and her point of view and always coming back to her and, you know, where you focus the close-ups. And, you know, so it's tricky, though, because we wanted to make him this big charismatic character, but then not take over. And I think just always with the camera, bringing it back to her and her point of view and being clear.
That's for me.
Yes, ma'am. What do you think? You like it?
I love it. I can't believe you did
that. All right, it's time to go. Silla's graduating.
Can I ask you something? I was wondering if maybe you could wait outside the ceremony. So I'm afraid you being there might take away the attention from the graduates.
Well, yeah, I guess I hadn't thought of it like that. I won't come here, man. I'll wait for you outside in the car. No way it'll kind of be like I'm there.
Thank you.
All right, let's go, baby.
How much does the period play into this, the period of time that we're talking about in the case of the Presley-Priscilla story? How did that play into what you presented?
Yeah, I think that was a big aspect of it. And that was a big part that excited me about building this world and 60s Memphis and just all the pageantry of that time. And I think it informs a lot of the story. That story wouldn't happen today like that. And just the way that, you know, the roles of women and the expectations were so different then. And I wanted to feel authentic to the time and look like that era.
Having given us the Marie Antoinette, having given us the Priscilla, those are two women in very specific situations. Is there something about that period in a young woman's life that particularly interests you? I think it's there across many of your films.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm always interested in stories about identity, and that's such a formative time. And I'm always curious about how people become who they end up being. So it's just a heightened time of, you know, kind of discovery and struggling. And yeah, it's interesting to see how people end up the way they are.
Thank you so much for being with us this evening, Sophia. Lovely to speak with you.
Thank you. Nice talking to you. Good night.
The release of Sideways 20 years ago, filmmaker Alexander Payne and actor Paul Giamatti proved that a movie about a depressed wine nerd could become a critical and commercial success. That film also created the so-called Sideways effect on global sales of Merlot, thanks to our hero's loud distaste for that particular red wine variety. Giamatti and Payne have reunited for the first time since Sideways to make The Holdovers, a seasonal story set in an elite New England boarding school in 1970, where Paul Giamatti's curmudgeonly Mr. Hunnam has the thankless task of babysitting the students with nowhere to go over the Christmas holidays. Eventually, his lone remaining charge is Angus Tully, 17-year-old child of a divorce, whose newly married mother ditches him in favour of going on a honeymoon. Tully is played by an extraordinary newcomer, Dominic Sessa. He was a student, in fact, at one of the schools the film was shot in when he was cast. And completing the dysfunctional central trio for the vacation period is Divine Joy Randolph, a school cook, Mary Lamb, who faces her first Christmas without her son, Curtis, who was killed in Vietnam. The film was a critical success in the US on release late last year. And just last week, it was a hit at the Golden Globes and the Critics' Choice Awards. And those in the know, predicting that Paul Giamatti could give our own Cillian Murphy a run for his money when it comes to the Oscar for Best Actor. More of that anon. Earlier today, I spoke to Golden Globe winners Paul Giamatti, as well as director Alexander Payne. I began by asking Paul Giamatti about the close family connections he has to the world of elite academia.
Yes, that's correct. Indeed, everybody in my family was teachers going back a couple of generations, and I did indeed go to a school kind of like the one in the movie. Yeah.
But your dad, A. Bartlett Giamatti, was president of Yale. I mean, we're talking a very high level of experience here.
He had a very successful academic career, for sure.
Now, when your family come to see a film like this one,
yes.
Do they come with a whole new set of perspectives that perhaps you don't want shared with you?
Well, not a lot of them are around anymore, but the ones that do go and see it, it does seem very familiar to them. Yes, when I watch the movie, it's deeply familiar, almost in a weirdly disconcerting way. When I watch it, it's so familiar that it's kind of odd to watch, yeah.
So you're telling me that when you had those Latin and Greek phrases to send out, you knew exactly what they were. You didn't need to be looked down at the script for the translation.
I didn't need to work on them at all. No, absolutely. I don't remember much of my Latin, and I never had Greek. I never did. Did you do Greek?
Not ancient Greek.
But not ancient Greek. Yeah. That's what I meant, yeah. I didn't have a good grasp of Latin anymore, unfortunately.
Well, Paul Hunnam certainly has a grasp of it, yeah. And he gives us plenty of it. To what extent, Alexander Payne, is the reading of a phone book related to Latin? Because was this a kind of audition for Paul Giamatti? You got him to read the phone book at some event, I believe, possibly subsequent to the making of the film.
I see you've done some research.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was proud to host Paul Giamatti in a public interview in my hometown of Omaha, Nebraska, and to make the point that I think he can make even the worst dialogue work. I produced a phone book and he read from it, and he did so brilliantly.
I guess there were some citizens of that particular part of the world delighted to have had their name read by Paul Giamatti.
That's a nice thought. I hope so. Yeah, I hope so.
Obviously, the reason he was cast was not his brilliance with the phone book. You have a long relationship. It goes back to Sideways, which is 20 years ago now.
Yes, this year marks its 20th anniversary of release. Yes, indeed.
What was it on, what friendship, what professional relationship was established on that film, would you say, that has carried through to this film?
Hmm. We just really enjoyed working together.
Yeah, we enjoyed each other's company. I mean, I suppose we became friends because of that movie, but yeah. And we just, we had a really easy working relationship that's just carried over.
And I like looking at him in movies.
That's nice.
Yeah.
I guess one of the things that strikes me, I mean, this is a story in some ways about family. It's an odd family. They're not blood family, Alexander, but they are a family, and that is something that interests you. It's the kind of thing that you have to create on a film set. It has to be like a family, rouse and all, I guess.
I think that's true, and I think I've been fielding some questions today, like, how did those three actors, you know, have such good chemistry? And I said, well, probably it started because we were all just happy to be making this movie together.
Yeah.
and they know they're the leads and happy to have those good parts.
And then, everybody's got a job, so everybody's happy.
That basic happiness extends then to the characters.
Yeah. Chemistry is it's a mystery. You know? Otherwise, it wouldn't be. You know, I mean, it's just a mystery a lot of the time. Who knows, too?
Plus, film has a wonderful capacity to lie. So you're just suggesting that they have chemistry, and the audience that's thinks
true.
That.
Yes, that's also true.
Yeah, and there are also chemical reactions or chemistry that can cause, you know, negative aspects to things.
Problems, yeah, for yeah. sure. Yeah.
And I have to say, your character's attitude to his pupils, let us say he's not always the most encouraging.
Salve, gentlemen. Your final exams. I can tell by your faces that many of you are shocked at the outcome. I, on the other hand, am not, because I have had the misfortune of teaching you this semester, and even with my ocular limitations, I witness firsthand your glazed, uncomprehending expressions.
Sir, I don't understand.
That's glaringly apparent.
No, it's... I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
I'm supposed to go to Cornell.
Unlikely.
Please, sir, my test's going to flip out.
Whistling Wagner and handing out failure tests, the results of tests where everybody has more or less failed. Not the nicest man in the world.
No, not the nicest. Thank you for recognizing I was whistling Wagner. I think you're the first person that's actually recognized I was whistling Wagner. Thank you. No, he's not the nicest man in the world, but Alexander makes a really important distinction between nice and kind. He's not a nice man, but he can be a kind and decent man underneath it all, which is, I think, that gets uncovered as the movie goes along.
And there is an argument, or is there an argument, again, going back to that education background of yours, sometimes to be a good educator, you can't be nice all the time.
No, I agree. I don't think he's wrong in a lot. I mean, he goes too far. But I think that his sense of discipline and rigor and things like that is not wrong. I mean, I think it's a good thing. There's a middle ground. I mean, he's missing the middle ground. He's going too far one way, but yeah.
Alexander, were you going to say something?
I had a teacher, a Latin teacher, who was like that. But is there a way of instilling rigor and discipline without using fear?
Yeah, I think so. I think you probably could do that. I mean, my father was, I think, a pretty rigorous and disciplined teacher without terrorizing people. Yeah.
Of fear, I think, extends back through the centuries.
Yes, I mean, no, definitely. I think that it's a tradition of beating it into people, and this guy's just carrying that on. But I don't think you have to do that. No, I don't think so.
I guess a director has to take a leaf out of that book as well, Alexander.
That's true. That's true.
I just break out in a rash.
He's a benevolent dictator.
Yeah.
Talk to me about, you obviously are really good at bringing out performances from young, like relatively, if not totally inexperienced actors. Dominic says as Angus Tully, who is the young guy that ends up, you know, in the threesome that makes up the dynamic of most of the film, the Angus Tully character, the Daveen's character, Mary Lamb, and of course Paul's character, Paul Hunnam. An extraordinary debut film performance.
Yes, extraordinary. And Sean, not to take your question too literally, but I didn't have to pull it out of him. He readily offered it. He's just we found a very talented young man, an uncannily talented young man.
Yeah.
No wonder you're afraid of women.
I am not afraid of women.
Sorry, Jesus, I shouldn't have said anything. It's... Dr. Gertler says I don't always give consideration to my audience.
Oh. And who is Dr. Gertler?
My shrink.
Has Dr. Gertler ever tried a good swift kick in the ass?
Okay. All right, now your turn. Go ahead. Tell me something about me. Something negative.
Something negative about you?
Sure. Just one thing.
Just one.
Ironically, within the milieu of the film's setting, that's where you found him.
Correct. It's kind of a miracle, a minor miracle, that he was a senior, you know, fourth year, last year student at one of the boarding schools where we were actually shooting. It's really something. Yeah. He'd never been in front of a camera before.
Never.
Star of the drama club, but that was it.
Yep. Did a couple of plays at the school, and that's it.
And is on a path to becoming a professional actor when he was, you know, he was applying to acting programs at university.
He was already pretty polished. It's crazy how professional he already was.
I was going to say he's quite far down that path already, isn't he? And for you, Paul, to see a young actor like that coming in, you mean you must remember early gigs and early jobs yourself where you were coming into very experienced rooms or onto very experienced sets. What was your feeling for Dominic in that situation?
This kid had it easy. I got to tell you. I remember when I went into these things, I was just thrown in the deep end without any. Nobody gave a damn whether I knew what was going on or not. No, the kid did have it. I mean, it's a nice situation for him, but it was nice to be around somebody who's so fresh and new to it. Made me kind of see it through those eyes again, which was nice. It did. Yeah, it really did.
And that dynamic that builds between the two of you, it is almost father-son, and father-son is a big theme in terms of both your character and his character.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, for sure. I certainly developed an affection for Dom that helped the affection that the guy eventually feels for the other character, for sure. But yeah, he didn't need a lot of help from me. He didn't need a lot of paternal protection from me.
No, but you've said that really the help you offered him was simply giving him confidence boosting, like, hey, you're doing great.
Reminding him of how great he was,
The decision, Alexander, because I think David Hemmingson in his original screenplay had it in and around the 1980s. You pulled it back to the 1970s, and that look that you give us, even at the top of the film, it feels like I'm at a film in the 1970s. And I mean that as a compliment. You know, the look of the film on scene, the look of the titles, the sound, the crackle of Silas falling onto LP. How important was that aspect of the film for you?
First, not that it matters that much, but let me correct something at the first part of your question. His pilot, this is not a version of his pilot. This is a completely different story. Mm. And yes, that one was set in 1980, but completely separately, we decided to again, not very important, but anyway. Well, it was super important because that's what we were doing. You know, I wanted it to look and sound like a movie made in 1970 to some degree. I thought it would be really fun to pretend I was a director working in 1970. And I'm happy with how it worked out, mostly because it doesn't feel like a period movie. It feels like a contemporary movie made in 1970. That's the aesthetic I wanted.
And does that help in terms of the performance side of things, Paul? Do you think you're back into the 1970s? How does that work?
Yeah, I enjoy anything period. And so, you know, it's always more evocative, the costumes, the sets, all those things are wonderful for actors, you know. And but for sure, and the textures of the clothes and the textures of the 70, the sound of it, the feel of it was, yeah, always important. Yeah.
I wondered what parallels, if they are useful at all, Paul, that you might have seen between Paul Hunnam and the character in The Holdovers and Miles from Sideways. I mean, they're both intelligent. They're both sensitive. I hate to point out they're both hopeless with women. They're both chronic underachievers and both functioning alcoholics.
Yes, that's indeed true. And I suppose there are similarities. You could answer this better than me. I don't know that.
You know, could have also focused on what's different between them.
Well, that's true.
I definitely like this character more. You know, I mean, I don't. There are all those similarities. And I think this guy is. He's a tougher guy. He's a less self-pitying guy. He's got more backbone. I think he's kind of, his sense of sort of, his sense of self is stronger in some ways. I kind of like him. I like him more, this guy.
But actors will often say, you know, you can't afford sometimes to like or dislike your characters. Is that part of the, because his un-niceness, if you like, you talk about his kindness being important there. You kind of have to ignore in some ways his un-niceness, if that's even a word.
But I liked this guy from the beginning. I don't even think, I mean, he's not nice, but I think I recognized that kindness. And I think even from the beginning, I just always thought, this guy, I mean, he's a bit of a prick, but he's a fun prick, and he's a guy, he's, you know, and he's a smart prick, and he's, I don't know, I liked this guy. So that helped a lot with it. I never had a barrier to get over. I never had some sense of like, oh, I have to find what I like about this guy. I just did like him. And that might be because I grew up around a lot of these people and I liked them. They're weird. They're odd. They're eccentric, you know, and I like that about these guys.
I have to mention the elephant in the room, if you don't mind, Paul. The Oscars.
Oh.
You know you're on Irish radio right now. You know that Cillian Murphy.
Boy, I hadn't even thought of that. Wow. Uh-oh. he's you know, actually one of the nicest things about this process that we've been going through is actually getting to know him.
Yeah.
He's a really, really nice guy. And I've really enjoyed meeting him and getting, because I've always admired him. I think he's a fantastic actor, but he's a really, really good guy. I like him a lot. He's a really nice
man. Did you watch Peaky Blinders?
A little bit. He's terrific on it. He's always great. And so that's been a really good thing. That's been a really good thing. So I just want all of Ireland to know that I admire Cillian Murphy.
Well, listen, if he doesn't win it, we don't mind. We don't mind if you win it.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. Thank you. I have Irish blood in me, by the way.
Oh,
I have
yes. Tell us more.
I don't know where they're from. Callahan. There's Callahans on my mother's side of the family, but I'm not sure where they're from in Ireland. But I do have Irish ancestry.
Well, listen, the Callahans of wherever they are, I expect to get a text from them on 51551 in the next 5 or 10 minutes, and I shall immediately dispatch it to you, Paul Giamatti, so that you know where the Callahans live, and you can go and either show them your Oscar or get Cillian Murphy to come with you and show them his Oscar. How's that?
Okay, great. Sounds good. Deal.
Paul Giamatti, Alexander Payne, thank you so much for being with us, Stephen. Thanks for
the interest. Thank you. Very good to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thank you.
Take care.
Arena.
Isolation and grief lie at the heart of all of us strangers, the new film from Andrew Haig, starring our very own Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal. Adam, played by Andrew Scott, lives alone in a chic central London apartment, though the building itself is eerily underoccupied. The only other person he encounters is Paul Mescal's Harry, a younger man who hits on him one night after a fire alarm. Through their burgeoning relationship, we hear the tragedy of Adam's young life and his attempts now to reconnect spiritually and literally with his parents, who were killed in a car accident when he was just a child. Acclaimed actors Claire Foy and Jamie Bell play those parents. The movie is adapted from Taichi Yamada's novel Strangers, and at the weekend I met stars Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal, along with filmmaker Andrew Haig. First of all, let's listen to a scene from the film where Paul Mescal's Harry, a little the worse for wear, knocks on Andrew Scott's character Adam's door, and Harry is holding a very nice bottle of Japanese whiskey.
Drink. It's Japanese. It's meant to be the best in the world, but I couldn't tell you why, so.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, how about I come in anyway? If not for a drink, then for whatever else you might want.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Do I scare you?
No.
We don't have to do anything if I'm not your type.
There's vampires at my door.
Andrew Scott, Paul Mescal, welcome to Arena. Thank you. What have you two guys done with this film? It is an extraordinary piece of work.
Thank you so much.
How quickly did you know, Andrew?
I knew when I read the script that it was an extraordinarily, beautifully, specifically written script. And when we started to see it with audiences and how profoundly affected everybody is watching it, we kind of knew this is something that's really connecting with audiences. And we knew when we were filming it, right? Yeah. We knew that it was, you kind of know a little bit that it was.
Yeah, special. Well, it was like, you can always tell that the performances that you're watching and the notes that Andrew is giving you is moving you, that's the only thing that like you have a kind of barometer for as an actor. So yeah, it felt very special when we were filming it, for sure.
Really struck me about, you know, and this sounds so negative, how damaged they both are, but what's extraordinary about that damage is they treat it so differently.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thinking of that opening scene, or that early encounter, where Paul, as Harry asks Adam, are you afraid? I'm not afraid at all, says Adam. How frightened is he?
Oh, I think he's frightened. That's what the essence of the film, I think, is about letting love in. Yeah. It's very cinematic and very symbolic. Mm. You can't let him into the house yet. Yeah. And I think the beautiful symbolism in the film is that you have to, as scary and frightening as it is to let somebody in who's beautiful and dangerous and can see you and who you can see. That's not sometimes, even the fact that you can see someone, you're attracted to something in somebody. Sometimes but the readiness is all, you know.
Mm.
He's just not ready to, and that's what the journey of the movie is.
And in some ways, Paul, Harry is the direct opposite of that. He's so, hey, I'm here, I'm available, whatever you want, I'm here to give it to you. But I don't believe him either when he says that.
Absolutely. He's this person who kind of skirts above his own feelings. He knows, it's almost like he's a great actor. He knows, like he'll go out, he'll take drugs, he's a bit of a party boy, he's very front-footed. But he's doing that all in an attempt to never have to stop and analyze. And what I think that they both give each other in the film is Harry gives Adam an energy that's forcing him to kind of ignite. Mm. And Adam is giving Harry the space to pause and talk.
Mm.
And well, that's an extraordinary gift and a very simple thing on paper, but a very difficult thing in reality, in life. Yeah. And I think that they both, the fact that they see each other and know what the other person requires, I find very moving.
Me too, me too.
And the other aspect of that is, I mean, on the surface they're doing one thing, all of this other stuff is going on internally, and you both play that, you know, we as the audience see that internal life. What kind of work did you do with Andrew Haig on that internal life, on that background material, if you like?
Well, I suppose one of the things, the greatest thing that you can act, I believe, is sometimes forthright is a wonderful thing to act, but sometimes feeling something and presenting something else is a wonderful thing to
you're
act.
The master of that, though.
I think it's a gorgeous thing to, because I think so much of us we have duality going on all the time, that there's, we all have this history that we can't help bringing. And so Andrew's, I think, really recognized that in the script. Andrew Haig's script was so, it's just, you look forward to acting, you think, wow, it's so much there on the page, and there's so much opportunity for acting, and there's only four of us in the film. It's so intimate. So just to be able to do it with the best actors in the world, you know, was extraordinary.
And obviously that emotional intensity, people talk about the physical aspect of the relationship, but it's the emotional intimacy between Adam and Harry that I find,
and
actually,
they're challenging with each other, you know, isn't that right? That's how love, I think, manifests itself.
When you say that line, the one when you're like, but it's not, why is it okay? You say a thing, Harry says something that he's trying to use his tactics to skirt over the top of it. And you say something that is, like, again, one of the simplest things to say.
Yeah.
It's so full of love, because he's like, explain to me why that's okay.
Yeah, and Harry does it to Adam when he goes, oh, well, this horrible thing happened to me a long time ago. And he says, why does that matter?
Yeah, why does it
it's
matter?
It's so loving. It's so beautiful. Yeah. And when you get to act that, and it's expert writing.
And then there's that conceit of the parents, and Adam sees the parents as they were when he was 12, you know, when they were killed in that awful car crash.
Yeah.
So you playing that, Andrew, you know, how far back into your own childhood did you find yourself going?
Because
there are times you were both an adult and a child when I was looking at you in screen.
Yeah, I felt, we shot it in Andrew Haig's, our director's childhood home.
Extraordinary.
And there was the production design of that house, that suburban house, which is not dissimilar to the little house that I grew up in, you know, in the 1980s, and all the kind of toys that you would have.
And
you open up the drawer and you think, oh my God, I had that copybook when I was at school. And I was taking pictures and sending them to my siblings and going, do you remember having this? And there is something that you just remember really in a really sensual way about your childhood home. And that conceit really worked.
Mm.
We didn't know, because Claire and Jamie are younger than me.
Yeah.
If that was going to work. But actually, it's the role. It's not the age that's interesting. It's the role. And actually, if you can put yourself imaginatively into a childhood place, you do it now. You know, I'm an adult and I still play I'm still a child with my, my parents.
It's essential to be an actor to still be a child. In some ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. Exactly right.
Which brings me to, how childish are Irish people? What is going on with Irish actors? I mean, look at the Oscars last year. Look at the awards that both of you are hauling in on a regular basis, not just, as I hope, for this film, but for lots of other stuff too. What has caused that, do you think, first of all, Andrew? Because you came from, you know, that kind of late 80s, 90s theatre background.
Yeah, I don't know. We were talking about it earlier on. It's a confidence, I think. There's an internationalism that the internet, that being able to audition for international things and the proximity of actors. You know, I was just saying, when I started off, you had to put your audition tape in an envelope and send it off over to LA. Now you can just send it. So an executive in America will go, well, just get me that person. I don't care how where they are. So it feels, the world just feels a little smaller.
Yeah, exactly. That's,
I think that helps. So Irish actors are being able to be seen, frankly.
I think also culturally we have a history of storytelling. Like it's
innate in
our culture.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that I like working about actors, Irish actors in particular, is that they pay attention in equal parts to the character, but also the story. Yeah. I think when I've worked with actors that I haven't enjoyed as much, and it's to do with they're extraordinary actors and great at playing their part, but they don't have an acute awareness of the story.
The entire story.
And I think that's kind of what I think is maybe definable about Irish acting.
Yeah.
Or to me, that's what I would say. When I'm working with you, I think you have an acute awareness of your character, but also what the story's about.
Well, I suppose it means that you have to, in a whole symphony, you have to play. The notes are interesting, but it's when you place them and when you reveal stuff, isn't it?
And what else is in the music at that moment?
Exactly, and you go, I'm not going to play that note yet, I'll play it later. And I also think, I suppose emigration is a big thing, because how you keep people alive is by telling stories about them. And so if somebody has left the country, or if you want to remember Ireland, you tell stories about it, and you tell really specific stories, and probably you never let the truth get out. Maybe a good story.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful performances. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That was the Pet Shop Boys concluding tonight's arena with their version of the Elvis hit Always On My Mind, which of course features prominently in the film we just heard Paul Mescal and Andrew Scott talking about, All of Us Strangers. Arena's Olympiad returns tomorrow at 9:00.